Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game.
Legendary actor Julie Andrews.
Becomes a piece of cake.
The first two roles Julie Andrews landed in Hollywood were Mary Poppins. And Maria in The Sound of Music. Iconic characters that captured the hearts of children and adults in the 1960s and still do today. And just like that, Andrews became a star whose Hollywood career lasted for decades. Andrews' new memoir, Homework, gives readers a glimpse into her life off-screen and showcases the less glamorous side of celebrity. Julie Andrews co-wrote this book with her daughter, Emma Walton Hamilton. I spoke with both of them.
Hello, Diane. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. How wonderful to hear your voice.
And I'm sitting here with my sweet Emma, and we're very delighted to be talking with you again.
Hi, Diane.
Hi,
how nice to hear
Emma.
Your voice. We miss you on the radio every day.
Yes, we do.
You know, I think, Julie, that our listeners who may not have read the first book in this series, this one called Homework and the first called Home, may not quite understand the extent of the difficulties you had in your childhood. Can you go over those for us?
In retrospect, it was a very unusual childhood in that my parents divorced when I was quite young, and my mother remarried a man who was a tenor. He was a Canadian. He was a singer. Very good tenor voice. And I was about 4 or 5, I guess, when I finally went and joined them, which meant splitting from my brother. My brother went with my father. I went with my mother. And to cut a very long story short, my stepfather, who was a little scary to me, a very big man with healthy appetites and so on, decided to give me singing lessons to keep me quiet, so to speak, because the war had made my school shut down and I was underfoot and nobody knew what to do and I was probably being a brat. Anyway, when he started giving me singing lessons, he discovered, to my surprise, to my mother's surprise, that I had this freak voice, this really strong 4 or 5 octave range that could do an amazing gymnastics, and he very quickly transferred me to his singing teacher, with whom I studied for many, many, many years. And eventually, at about age 12, vaudeville beckoned, and I went out and travelled all over England endlessly. And then gradually, wondering what my life was going to be after vaudeville, thinking that it was just a quick flash in the pan, so to speak, and that the success I had was going to fade, and then what would I do? And I suddenly was invited to go to Broadway and to do 3 shows, The Boyfriend and My Fair Lady and Camelot, and many television shows and things like that. And suddenly, from there, I was asked to go to Hollywood, and the first film I ever made was Mary Poppins.
And indeed, you spend a great deal of time in the book talking about Mary Poppins and about The Sound of Music. However, I do want to mention that for a long time, you were supporting your family, while at the same time, you were making a name for yourself on that vaudeville route.
Well, it was what it was. At the time, I certainly didn't think it was that huge. I mean, the effort was tremendous, but it didn't seem as tremendous as it did when I wrote about it in the memoirs. So the first memoir goes until the end of my time on Broadway, and that's just called Home, as you said. And then the second memoir begins when Walt Disney came and very kindly asked me to go to Hollywood. But yes, I did and have for many years helped support. I mean, I just think it's what families do when they can.
But little children are rarely asked to support entire families, which is what you actually did.
Yeah, I was fortunate in that I guess I was the one that was making a little bit of money and so did what I could to help the family through.
Indeed.
Because we were very, very poor to start with, and there were a lot of family difficulties. My stepfather was an alcoholic, and my mother, who played the piano most beautifully and should have been a concert pianist, eventually became an alcoholic also, which was heartbreaking.
You know, what strikes me about the title of your book is that for anyone who aspires to a Hollywood career, what you make very clear in this book is the amount of work that really goes.
Well, it's no accident that the book is called Homework, because it is home has always resonated for me, which is obviously why the first book was called Home, meaning what is home? Is it really home? Is it theater? Is it my singing? Is it music? It's all of it. And then homework is really the work that I did learning about Hollywood and learning about myself. And yes, when I began to write about it and look at those diaries that I kept, suddenly the amount of work that I had done came crashing through. And even I was surprised. I mean, what I took away from writing this second memoir was, gosh, I guess I did work hard.
Yeah,
we talked about that. Yeah.
Emma, I do wonder about your own reaction as you read about your mother's experiences through her diaries.
Yes, it was an extraordinary experience, as you can imagine, Diane, a tremendous privilege to be entrusted with those diaries and to be allowed to take the journey of reading them. What was fascinating for me was to read them while remembering my own experiences of many of the same events from a child's point of view. And of course, you know, when I was a child and let's just say would visit mom on a film set, I would be thinking, well, she's mom and she's a grown-up and grown-ups know everything and have all the answers and are on top of it all. But of course, as an adult and a parent myself now of an adult child and an almost adult child, I now fully realize that we never feel we know it all and we never really feel we're on top of it all. And
now you do.
And now I read with great interest the moments of insecurity in my mom's diaries, you know, as she was navigating her life as a young parent and as a young artist in Hollywood
new
and new wife and so forth. And I had a great deal of empathy and identification, but also marveled at the contrast between the truth of that and my perception of it as a child when it happened at the time.
Tell us about Tony Walton.
Oh, well, that's Emma's dad.
Emma's first husband.
Yeah, and he is a dear friend still, I'm very happy to say. Oh, Emma, come on, you can help me with all of this.
You were childhood sweethearts, and I think that's the sweetest part of the story.
We came from the same village, yes.
Wasn't it at age 12 or 13
met? And he did become my best friend and a childhood sweetheart, and thank heavens, because now we have this lovely daughter of mine who's the result of all that.
And you meet Walt Disney, who sees you perform in Camelot.
That's right.
And at the same time, he invites Tony to help with the
sets
preparations
and costumes,
for scenery and background for Mary Poppins.
And the costumes, yes. So both of us were hired by Mr. Disney That's the amazing thing about Walt Disney. His talent for spotting talent was tremendous, and he saw instantly how very, very beautiful Tony's designs were, how smart and clever, and it was an instant decision, which it takes a bit of doing, and he obviously had, as I say, had a great talent for that kind of thing.
Well, here you were caring, both of you, caring for infant Emma, mm-hmm. and taking a crash course in film acting alongside Dick Van Dyke.
Right, and Hollywood all around us, so to speak. It was a very interesting time, and Dick Van Dyke was lovely and far more seasoned than I was. He knew what he was doing, and little by little, I began to learn about the ways of how to make a movie. And I mean, I had no idea when I began.
What was that like, doing a musical for film after you had been on Broadway?
Daunting, to say the least. Also, if you think about it, when you do a show on Broadway, a musical on Broadway, or anything in the theater, you are full figure all the time, and you start at the beginning and finish at the end of your story. But in film, it is broken up into many, many pieces, like a jigsaw, and assembled later. And so you could be filming, your first scene could be the middle of the movie, or the end of the movie, or whatever. And depending on the expense of the movie and what the budget was, and you'd have to shoot all the scenes indoors in the house, let's say, at one time, and then all the exteriors at another time, and on from there. So I was learning, in the case of film, you hold the whole film in your head and have to know roughly where you hope to be going and what you hope to achieve, and then just pray with the help of a fine director that you end up where you'd like to be, or somewhere in the ballpark.
And from Mary Poppins, you go on to somewhat reluctantly accept the role of Maria in The Sound of Music. Why were you reluctant?
I wouldn't exactly say I was reluctant. Maybe just a twinge of nervousness would be probably a better description, that this too was a role about a nanny, somebody who cares, you know, for a group of children, and that the musical of that I'd seen on Broadway of The Sound of Music, much as the music itself was glorious, I worried that the story might be just a tad saccharine in terms of all the themes involved in that story. You know, the countryside, the Alps, the nuns, the kids added to the music, and it's a love story. And it also has stories about, you know, the war is looming. And I just hoped that if I did it, I mean, I wanted to accept it and was advised, of course, to accept it, and that I could make it as astringent as possible to kind of not wallow in the more syrupy or sweet aspects and make it a real, real story. And I think, happily, Robert Wise, our director, and obviously lovely Christopher Plummer, helped so much and felt exactly the same way.
Now, during those films, you are raising Emma. Emma is a baby girl, and you feel your marriage is slipping away. What was happening?
Oh, too much, probably. So much work, so much time away from Tony, and such a lot preoccupying both of us, because Tony's career had blossomed as well as mine, and he was not only all over America but back in England, and he just exploded in his own way into the world of art and design. I mean, we'd been friends for a great many years, so it at first seemed very simple that being apart from time to time was pretty normal, but then it did take its toll, alas. And eventually, I don't know It was one of the most sad days of my life, was when Tony and I divorced, but felt necessary, and it wasn't because at that time there was anybody else in the running. It was just something that seemed right at the time.
So at the recommendation of your friend Mike Nichols, you start psychoanalysis. What was that like for you?
He didn't recommend it as much as I watched Mike, who was in therapy and had been for years, and friends of mine who also were in therapy. And I knew one or two very special psychoanalysts, one of whom was a great friend. And little by little, the importance of sorting out my own head and getting rid of what I would call just the garbage and the clutter and sticking with the essentials seemed to me to be really important. I liked what I saw in people who had the clarity of having been psychoanalyzed, and I wanted it for myself, Diane.
And would you say it helped you a great deal?
Oh, I would say it helped in more ways than I could possibly describe.
Yes.
It cleared the clutter. It helped me think in a more linear fashion. I think and hope that I'm a better mother, was a better mother, a wife to Blake, understood so much more about my own family and my own upbringing, and put a lot in perspective and provided a lot of compassion, too.
Now, I have to tell you that one of the favorite all-time desserts that I make
is... What can this be?
English trifle.
Oh, okay.
And I want you to tell the story of getting into Mike Nichols' Rolls Royce.
With my trifle.
With your trifle. This is hysterical.
Well, it didn't feel so hysterical at the time. I was mortified. I knew that Mike liked trifle and that we were going to spend an evening together as friends. We'd work together, and he was a great friend. And I think we'd seen a film together or something like that. And we were going to have supper. So I made a trifle and took it very carefully into the car.
Rolls Royce.
And his brand new Rolls Royce, needless to say. And there we took off, and I showed him the trifle and said, "This is for later." And he suddenly braked the car because somebody crossed in front of him. And my trifle, which was a little bit sloppy, unfortunately, sort of rolled forward and back toward my lap and then slopped forward again and went straight into the air conditioning of his Rolls Royce. And I was mortified. Mike very generously and kindly thought it hilariously funny. And I said, "Mike, your beautiful car." And he said, no, it can be cleaned, I promise you. And he did get it cleaned up. The only trouble being that the next guest in the car, when he turned on the air conditioning, received a face full of custard that had gone rather rancid.
Emma, does Julie ever make trifle for you?
Not anymore, thankfully.
Never again. I'm a rotten cook.
I think that experience might have scarred her for life.
I can't cook, Diane. I try very hard. I do good breakfasts.
She makes terrific scrambled eggs.
Yeah, I'm a good breakfast queen and pancakes and things like that. But I'm not a happy cook. I'm very insecure. And it's difficult to be a good cook when your husband is a very good cook who can improvise on a dime, and I was very intimidated by that.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Julie Andrews and Emma Walton Hamilton. Now we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with actor Julie Andrews and her daughter, Emma Walton Hamilton. together. They wrote the new book titled Homework, a memoir of my Hollywood years. Tell me how you actually met Blake Edwards, that first meeting.
I was new and beginning my therapy, and I was driving toward my appointment one day, crossed Sunset Boulevard, and there's a meridian in the middle of Sunset. It's a very hokey story. And because of traffic, pulled up in the middle of the, you know, the center meridian, and a car came the opposite direction and pulled up beside me. And it was a very good-looking Rolls-Royce, hint, hint. And I drove on, and then 2 days later, the same thing happened, same car. And then a few more days later, the same thing happened. And finally, the driver rolled down the window and said, "Hello, are you going where I just came from?" And I smiled and said, "I suspect so." And he said, "Well, I'm Blake Edwards, and it's nice to meet you, Miss Andrews." And I hadn't realized that it had been Blake. And he was in therapy and had just finished his session, and I was just going to mine on the street where most of the doctors were in their offices. So that's how we met. Very shortly after that, I think 2 or 3 weeks after that, I got a call from his assistant saying, could we possibly arrange a meeting because Mr. Edwards had a film he'd like to discuss.
Uh-huh.
I know I was approached about possibly being in a film while I was in The Sound of Music of The Great Race, but I couldn't do it because of timing. I was still making The Sound of Music, and I knew that I would love to have worked with the great Blake Edwards because I was a great fan of his work.
And ultimately, you worked together as a wonderful couple.
Well, 7 movies and several specials on television and things that we did together. I mean, it was a very joyous collaboration. And he was my love. He was charismatic and a difficult man, but God, he was my man and I loved him.
A difficult man in what sense?
Just difficult in that he had like 6 ideas a day, and who knew which one was going to just take off and become another movie or a play or whatever. He suffered from depression. He flirted eventually during depression with drugs that mostly calmed him, because I think he felt stress, understandably so, in the industry the way it was in those days. He was just complicated and charismatic. Emma, you can talk to some of that.
Emma, how did you and Blake get along?
Well, it was complicated, Diane. I was mom's daughter from a prior marriage, which I think sometimes stuck in his craw a bit. I know he loved me, and he had 2 of his own children from a prior marriage as well. So we were a mixed family, and eventually Mom and Blake adopted my 2 younger sisters.
Yes.
But, you know, it's interesting. We loved each other very much, Blake and I. We respected each other very much, but it was complicated in that we often butted heads, I should say.
Because I think you dared to tell him the truth sometimes.
Yeah, I have that terrible genetic predisposition to say, does anyone else see the elephant in the middle of the room? And he wasn't very fond of that at times, I think.
Julie, tell us about your decision to adopt those 2 baby girls.
Quite simply, Blake and I hoped to have more children. We were not getting lucky in spite of having... he had children from a previous marriage and I had my lovely Emma, but... I think life was so complicated, and with the pressure of making a new family, I just wasn't happily getting pregnant. And it didn't matter. We wanted children, and I think it was a very political time. You know, the war in Vietnam was escalating, coming to a close. Children were in desperate need. Seemed like an appropriate thing to do, to adopt from Vietnam, and it was a quick adoption, and some friends of ours had also adopted and knew a good agency. So we wrote off and asked if we could take a child. And within 11 months or so, our first daughter arrived at 5 months old. And then literally within 3 months, our second daughter arrived.
Wow.
Who was 2 months old, because Saigon did fall, and or Ho Chi Minh City did fall. And if we hadn't gotten another child quickly, she would have been stuck there. And so we took Amy and Joe, and they became our babes and part of our family. And then now, I mean, it's 40-something years later now, and they're grown ladies.
Emma, you haven't talked about how you've helped your mother write this book. Talk about that a bit.
Well, this is book number 32 of our collaborations, if you can believe it, Diane, most of which have been children's books.
Yes.
But we did collaborate on Mom's first memoir, and this one picked up where that one left off. And my role in both cases was really to facilitate the process of her being able to tell her story as best I could.
And I couldn't have done it without her, Diane.
What
please
do
go
you
on
mean?
In.
What do
well,
you mean, Julie?
What I mean is, in both cases, we started with my building a timeline from which to work, and essentially a very detailed timeline of all the events in her life and the various things that happened on different days and in different parts of the world. And each step of the way, as we would come to another event in the timeline, I would say, talk to me about, you know, recording such and such, or talk to me about filming or this scene on such and such a day. And so we did a great deal of interviews together, which we recorded and then had transcribed and used those transcripts as some of the roots of the narrative. And then I also had the privilege and the ability to read all of Mom's diaries and journals. And so in the reading of those, I was able to pull out the sections that seemed important for us to discuss and to consider incorporating into the manuscript, whether in a retelling form or as a direct excerpt.
And then we began the big writing.
and that gave us the bare bones. And then from there, we began the revision process together, which was, you know, just reading and rereading and editing and revising and polishing.
And researching so, so much.
That's right.
As we went, and photographs too, and articles, and thank God for the internet as well, which, when we weren't sure about something, provided some answers.
You come to a very simple conclusion about your life at the end of the book, and I so identify with you. You feel so lucky.
I do. I do. I'm the lucky lady that was asked to make those movies. I'm the lucky lady that's got my sweet Emma at my side when I write, and all my other lovely kids. And life has been extraordinary. It's been, as I say in the book, it's been a lot of homework, and I've had a lot of homework that I've had to do on myself to adjust to it all. But that all has been such a gift that I feel was given to me. And we all get opportunities in life, but I've had so many.
Will there be a third book?
Well, from your lips to book buyers' ears, Diane, I think there are certainly more stories to tell. And this book took us 2.5 years to write, so it would mean another couple of years' commitment on our part.
It's a daunting prospect at this point.
But, indeed, at this point, Julie, you are 84, I am 83. Let's just keep going.
Well, yes. I think I still feel I want to, and I'm still so stimulated and curious about things, as you obviously are, Diane, thank God. And life is still very, very interesting, complicated these days with the world the way it is. But
indeed.
But nevertheless, I think the best we can do is raise our kids to be good citizens and help them to be able to vote wisely and sensibly and just pray for them and their future and try to make it a better place.
Well, the beauty of it is that you two are so lucky to have each other.
I think we recognize that.
We do.
I have a sign in my house over my door of my kitchen, and it just says, "Are we lucky or what?"
Indeed.
And I say it to everybody to the point where they say, "Oh, Mum, shut up." But it's so true, Diane. It really is.
Well, Julie, Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you, and wonderful to talk to you, and good luck.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, Diane. Thank you for having us.
God bless.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher, Josephine Neonai, and Natalie Yurevlivker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.